Thanks to that, John. And yeah, welcome to Brisbane and Musgrave Park for another broadcast for 3CR from the Aboriginal Sovereign Tent Embassy. And today was a big day up here in Brisbane. It was the People's March, as well as the another march from the Aboriginal Sovereign Tent Embassy, all started in the city. And yeah, headed down back here to the park at Musgrave Park in Brisbane. And of course, as we've been saying all week, we're only a short distance from the convention centre where the G20 is happening. But it's much nicer to be here in the park, where I am joined by a longtime ex-3CR presenter, Dave Sweeney.
Afternoon, Michael.
Afternoon, Dave. It's good to see you up here.
Yeah, it's very good to be here. It's really good. It was great also to walk into the park today and see 3CR like on display at top of the hill and broadcasting. It's great.
We kind of made a scene for ourselves up here on the hill. So what's brought you to Brisbane?
Well, basically, you know, being one of the G7 billion who's not represented by the G20, I am here both personally to lend my voice, but also organisationally. Like, I work with the Australian Conservation Foundation, a mainstream major environmental NGO. And, you know, we thought it was really important to be part of this, the people's expression of dissatisfaction, you know, like... We've got a day where people are flaking in the heat in Brisbane, and then we've got a Prime Minister in aircon saying that climate change doesn't exist, you know. So we want to see some real action on addressing, you know, environmental issues, on advancing sustainability, on advancing equality and some equity. And we want to see, you know, those things make the agenda. And we want to, I suppose, to put forward the case that... the, you know, natural capital, the earth and the living planet that sustains life, is the precursor and the precondition, the capital,
yep,
to financial capital. So let's get serious about that discussion, what it means, and how do we, you know, share, what do we do that's sustainable and makes things more equitable. So, you know, it's part of having that discussion personally, having that discussion like formally on stages and in forums, and just, you know, putting the flag to the mast, basically.
Yeah, because a lot of that stuff's just not appearing on the G20 discussions at all, is it?
No, it's not at all.
Most of that's off the table kind of thing.
Absolutely, and where there has been discussion about energy issues, it's been about, like, how can we facilitate trade agreements to facilitate the traffic of dirty energy.
Yeah.
You know, Australia's playing this role of, you know, we're the energy broker for coal and uranium, and both of them, you know, one chokes us, one radiates us. No, neither are good, neither are necessary, neither are desirable. Let's turn it off and move into sustainable and renewable systems. And that's where the discussion's got to be. So there's this whole thing, Michael, you know, no surprises to any listener that it's cloaked in economic rationality, which is irrational, and it's cloaked in talk about the value of jobs, and we're all into jobs, but they've got to be meaningful jobs and sustainable jobs and real jobs. And what we've got here is a vast thing which is quite extraordinary. 100 people have the same, you know, 100 individuals have the same wealth on this planet as the least rich 3 billion. That's absurd.
It's just insane, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it was a reasonable turnout today for the...
Yeah, I reckon it was. Like, it was really hot.
Yes.
And it was also, like, it was...
hot.
Yeah, it was hot. Melbourne, it was very hot up here. It was 40-plus degrees and it's hot. And it's a weird thing up here, too. It's a northerly wind is a cool wind and you welcome it. It's
yeah,
funny.
Yeah, which is the opposite, yeah.
Yeah. But I was welcome when the northerly kicked in today. So it's hot. I reckon that kept people's numbers down a little bit. It's also, there's this... The Newman government made it a long weekend,
yes,
and encouraged people to go coastal.
Yep. Yeah, in papers all week, they were telling people to get out of town and go stay in the Gold Coast,
exactly,
or go to the country or something.
And here's these special deals.
Yeah.
And the other thing, I think, is that there has been for months this culture of there's going to be other freaks who are not like us, who,
yes,
are going to go run amok, and so don't take your kids, and, you know, it's not you, and if you're concerned about climate change, aren't we all, sort of, but don't get involved with these people.
Yeah.
I think that combination, that trifecta of heat, holiday and hazard, you know, meant that it was a smaller crew, but it was bright and bouncy, and 3,000 or 3,500 people, and people were really happy. And I've spoken to a few activists here who said that 3,500 here is like 30,000 to 40,000 in Melbourne.
Oh, okay.
And they were saying that,
yep,
using their equivalents of when there's a big climate rally or something,
yep,
they were saying they were very happy with
yep,
this show. And it was certainly, you know, there is a little bit of a thing of you want to ensure that there is contested space and that there are things put in the public domain and that there's an expression in the public realm and in the streets that isn't aggressive but is assertive and is challenging that narrative, and I think people did that. We all collectively did that today.
Yeah, no, it was good. And against all the hype that's been built up, the rally was peaceful, perfectly peaceful and enjoyable.
It was peaceful and it was enjoyable. It was funny, and there was really that combination of sweet and clever and really funny signs and comments that people had. There's kids on scooters, there's, you know, people with brass band, and there's instruments on the bridge, and there's all sorts of things. And it was a pretty broad and representative collection of people. It wasn't just one dynamic. The other thing that was really noticeable for me today, Michael, and really positive too, was just it was a lot of the stuff was really strongly driven by and focused around local Indigenous mob.
Yeah.
A very strong sovereignty sense, very strong respect sense.
They've been very organised this week.
They have been very organised.
The fourth march they've had this week.
Yeah.
And, they've kind of really well on top of it.
I reckon there'll be some blistered feet and sore throats, you know, feet up and throats on silent next week, but they've done extraordinarily well this week.
Yeah, I mean, Robbie Thorpe yesterday could barely talk.
Yeah, well, he got it together again by this morning. He
was amazing
rousing.
This morning, yes. He was, rousing the crowds up again, as he has been all week. So have you got much else on in Brisbane?
No, not really. I put out calls to Vladimir Putin and Barack Obama into a whole range to talk about nuclear policies, and also to see if I could meet the person who's always within 10 metres of them with a black box with the codes in it.
Of course, that's
really extraordinary that there actually is. We're here in Brisbane and there's a band playing in the distance and there's, you know, sausage sizzle and veggie burgers on and all that sort of stuff, but in a compound not far away are the leaders of the world's biggest ever military powers. And sitting within 15 metres of them is a person with a lock case that has the codes for nuclear weapons.
To wipe us all out, basically.
Yeah, it's quite... I found that quite, actually, you know, sometimes you go, yeah, of course, I know that. You sort of intellectually know that. But when we walk past that Congress today and there's coppers everywhere and it's all that sort of stuff, it really hit me that this is the world that they work in, this is the world that they're in, and this is the world that we are, you know, actively trying to change.
Yeah, no, and I mean, they've kind of, quite a few people point out today, they're from Brisbane, they've kind of ruined the city for everyone this week. Like, all the lockdowns, the place looks like a construction site, basically. There's just temporary fencing everywhere, there's road closures everywhere. I mean, it's really uncomfortable for the local people as well.
Absolutely. Look, I looked around for a coffee this morning. By the time I finally found a place that was open, the person who was, like, not a greatly switched-on political person who was working at the shop asked, was I here for the G20, apologised and said, you know, normally it's better than this, that normally it's a nicer place than this. So, yeah, you know, like, I feel sorry for Brisbane mob for all that grief that they've had to put up with for that sort of thing. Ridiculous today to see police from New Zealand and police with Victorian police.
Western Australian, everything,
You know, like, it's just quite absurd, quite over the top. 6,000 coppers, 3,000 demonstrators, it's absurd.
Because it's been all week they've been kind of, I mean, not harassing, they've been fairly peaceful, but we've been circled constantly. There's crowds of, you know, four gangs of police constantly circling the park all night. They've had the prison vans circling the park all week, kind of thing. It's this kind of like culture of intimidation all week. It's been quite amazing. But again, there's been no trouble here in the park, where everyone's been camped out and enjoying themselves all week. But yeah, there's just this constant, and the cost involved in just these police, like, you know, there would have been 40 police constantly just wandering the circuit of the park.
Yeah, it is absolutely absurd. People today routinely police sweeping through train carriages, what's in the bag. Yep. If you looked a little bit like you, you know, might be challenging the dominant narrative, can you open your rucksack?
Yeah. In the city, wandering around. I mean, I got asked for ID. I managed to avoid giving it to them, I'm quite happy to say, so they didn't know I'm here. But they, were actually asking, basically anyone kind of walking along the street. They just demand ID and, you don't have a choice.
One thing, you know, about the ageing process and getting grey hair, you know, it's a little bit like Moses in the Red Sea. The blue line parts for you and they sort of just think, well, you know, poor thing, you're nearly at a Zimmer frame, you can't be too dangerous. But it's just been extraordinary. And it's that thing too, I asked myself the question today of when did the country that we grew up in lose its ability to take the piss out of itself, to be self-reflective, to be have a sense of order, a sense of perspective. Like, these, you know, some people might be highly opinionated, but everyone in this whole exercise today has been gracious and generous, like from the protester side, and has been really about making the point, not about making a problem or a fight. And the analysis hasn't been that it's this copper's fault that, you know, the world's a mess.
Yep.
It's about, let's highlight the system.
Yep.
And, yet there has been this real sense that you are a troublemaker, and that we've really got it in every way. And it's hit me again, the importance of CR, community broadcasting, civil society groups, like the importance of ACF and Friends of the Earth and trade union groups being here today, just to say that this is a legitimate part of what it is to live in a democracy.
Yeah.
Don't cover yourself in the flag and talk about democracy and our way of life when you're actively, you know, restricting it.
Yeah, no, it's a terrible thing, but I think everyone proved today that it can still be done.
It can still be done.
Even under all that pressure and all that $1 billion or whatever they spend on security and stuff. It's massive amounts of money. I mean, the amount of people they could have fed or housed instead of spending all that money, which, to, you know, is basically wasted money. Because, it was unnecessary and unneeded, and, there's a lot better uses. I think they could have made of their time and money. But there you go. That's the G20 for you.
That is the G20 for you, and I think it's really important, like Brisbane has done it. You know, it needed to put the torch out there today. It needed to bang the drum a bit and say that we need to do a different and a better way of doing business, and people did it really well today, and I reckon full credit to organisers for what they've done.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thanks for talking to us, Dave.
Absolutely.
We're going to let you get back on your flight.
Yeah, not far away from one, so I'll do that. But really good to talk.
And it's great to see you again.
And great to see you here.
And a track there from Mop and the Dropouts, an old Brisbane band from, I think, about 20 years ago. And their track Brisbane Blacks, which we've been asked to play quite a bit up here. It's very popular, especially the elders here at the Aboriginal Sovereign Tent Embassy. Country music is very, very, very popular, I have to say. We've been asked to play lots of it when we've been DJing here in the park. Most of our broadcasts have been live here in the park, as well as sent back to Melbourne to broadcast across Melbourne. Of course, I should say, for anyone that's tuned in, we're broadcasting live from Musgrave Park in central Brisbane, or South Brisbane to be precise. A short walk from the river and just across from the city centre, and just a short stone's throw, or as someone said the other day, a short Shanghai shot from the convention centre, where the G20 is taking place today. And you've probably seen on the news, maybe. There's a mass rally today from the Sovereign Tent Embassy and from the People's Forum, which gathered in the city, listened to some speeches, as these things tend to do, but then had a nice, fun march through the city. No trouble at all, a very enjoyable day for everyone, and everyone's come back here to the park in Musgrave Park, where you can probably hear there's entertainment going on in the background. I think it's a local gypsy band playing at the moment. And the food tent has been run off their feet, feeding the hordes and masses this afternoon. But anyway, let's continue on with Let Your Freak Flag Fly. Of course, 3CR's broadcast from Musgrave Park finishes up tomorrow, where sadly we'll be finishing up our 9 days here camped out in the park, where we've been living and working for the last 9 days, about 12 of us up here. It's been a most enjoyable time, but yeah, sadly it all comes to an end tomorrow with the broadcast between 3 and 5, I think, tomorrow afternoon. But anyway, I should get on with the show. We're going to listen now to an interview done by one of the other 3CR broadcasters up here, Alex Gotts. She spoke to Bo Spiram, one of the organisers here with the Tent Embassy, and they spoke a little bit, I think it was yesterday. On the topic of movement building. So give me 1 second and we'll be listening to Bo Spiram.
You're listening to 3CR. We're coming live from Musgrave Park as part of our ongoing coverage of the decolonisation before profit events run by the Brisbane Blacks and the Brisbane Aboriginal Sovereign Embassy. I'm here with Bo Spiram. Hi, Bo. Would you like to introduce yourself and where you're from and what you're doing here?
My name is Bo Spiram. I'm Gamilaroi, Kuman Marawaru. Those three nations are located in northern New South Wales and southern Queensland. I was born in Sydney, but been a part of the Brisbane community since 1997. Very proud Brisbane Black. And I'm also part of the organising committee for the First Nations response to G20, the decolonisation before profit, here in Musgrave Park.
And you were recently overseas meeting with First Nations people around Turtle Island, which our listeners might also know as North America. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you've been able to apply some of the lessons that you learnt there in the organising that you've been doing here in Australia?
Definitely. No, you're correct. You know, like, myself and three others went to Turtle Island, so-called Canada, you know, for a month. You know, it took us 3.5 weeks to drive from one side of the country to the other, Vancouver to the east coast of the west coast to east coast. You know, and stopping off in different Aboriginal communities, visiting different protest camps, you know, blockade camps, you know, and just checking out, you know, and getting a perspective, an outsider's perspective on Indigenous resistance. You know, myself and the three others who went over, you know, has been involved in a lot of, you know, marches and rallies and organising here in Australia as young people, you know. And to go over there, you know, and have like an outsider's look, you know, on how other Indigenous peoples organise, rally and march and resist, you know, colonial policies, you know, like assimilation and resource extraction, you know, was very, very empowering. You know, and I think, you know, like we know, in, you know, like we're not alone when we talk about decolonization and colonial oppression. Like we know that we're not alone in terms of decolonization and colonial oppression, you know, but to see it in a physical form and to meet other mob, you know, was very, very inspiring. You know, you know, we met, you know, mob that was involved on, you know, frontline, you know, action. And we went to the Elsipogtog Reservation and met the proud Mi'kmaq Warrior Society and the warrior people. You know, last year, near the end of last year, they were having standoff with RCMP, which is like their Royal Mounted Police, paramilitary troops. You know, they wanted to start fracking and, extract minerals and resources, you know, from, you know, this nation, and the local community said, hey, nah, you know, we don't want this. You know, we want clean water. You know, we want a clean future for, you know, our future generations and today. You know, so they set up a blockade camp, you know, and they rallied, you know, against, you know, these massive imposing forces, you know, and it got to the point where, you know, the half of the town, you know, was there, you know, and them standing up, you know, brought other different Indigenous peoples, you know, from different nations, you know, from Turtle Island, you know, go and visit them and stand next to them, you know, not just in solidarity, but also, you know, to stand alongside them because of what is going on in their own territories. You know, you know, they had a standoff. You know, it got to the point where the RCMP retreated. You know, and the frustration from the community. You know, some young warriors, they burnt, you know, 6 cop cars. You know, set them alight. They told everybody, you know, turn the cameras off. Turn your cameras off. We're going to do something. You know, and they lit these cop cars up. You know. You know, we went to Winnipeg. They had a protest camp there set up, you know, and that was for the missing and murdered Aboriginal women. You know, it's like, it's almost 2,000 Aboriginal women, you know, that have been, you know, missing and murdered, you know, in the last 20 to 30 years. You know, we went to the Elsipogtog blockade on the west coast in British Columbia. And, like we talk about revival and resistance, you know, and seeing the stuff that these communities were doing, you know, in the Elsipogtog, I mean, sorry, in the Unistoten blockade camp, you know, what they had was they had action camps, and each action camp was revolved around Indigenous resistance and settlers, you know, understanding the importance of being led, you know, by an Indigenous perspective. You know, they built cabins, you know, that have 25 beds in there, you know, and another story, you know, full of beds. They built up a pit house, you know, which is a traditional winter house. You know, that hasn't been built on their territory within over 200 years. You know, they built a traditional veggie patch. And the funny thing about the veggie patch and the pit house is there on the GPS coordinates of the proposed pipeline that's supposed to be going over their territory. So at the exact time as they're resisting, you know, colonial oppression, they're also reviving, you know, which is something so special to them, you know, which is the connection to country and the connection that they need to have with themselves, you know. You know, they were, you know, these things were the biggest, you know, inspiration to me individually and to the four of us, is because you know, we got to see and understand, you know, Indigenous resistance on a global scale, you know, and how, you know, we're at that point now where we can have impacts just like they did. Mm. You know, we can, you know, have dialogue, you know, not just with our own mob in this country, but, you know, with them and with other Indigenous mobs. Because you know, when we talk about decolonisation, it is steps that need to be taken as all Indigenous peoples, yeah. You know, and that's where it begins, yeah. You know, with us, you know, because colonial oppression begins, you know, with an alien system being imposed, you know, on nations. You know, this alien system is the exact same, you know, that's on each continent, you know, around this world. You know, so what needs to fix it, you know, is that Indigenous, you know, resistance. Mm-hmm. You know, and in saying resistance, you know, Indigenous resistance, it's an organic, you know, it's something, you know, that's been in this continent and it's been in other continents, you know, from the first sunlight. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what makes it organic.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what makes it, you know, that's what gives it a heartbeat and a connection.
Some of the stuff that you've been doing this week, for listeners who haven't heard the rest of our coverage, there's been a Stop Stealing Our Children forum to, you know, with a lot of input from the Grandmothers Against Forced Child Removal. There's been, you know, forums against the fracking and mining and resource extraction on Indigenous land, stuff against... there was a forum on Native Title and, you know, looking beyond Native Title as a means of... looking beyond Native Title. Deaths in Custody was Friday, yesterday. And what there's been is a huge number of different Aboriginal people from around the nation coming together and meeting with each other. And is this for you? Are you seeing some of like the things that you mentioned from overseas, like a movement that's led from an Indigenous perspective, with you know, solidarity between lots of Indigenous nations? Is this the kind of thing that you're seeing in what's happened this week?
Yep. You know, and that's right, you know, because that's what needs to happen, you know. And Vivian Marlow, you know, said it right. There's a video of her on YouTube. You know, you're not going to get your freedom without ours, you know. And it's understanding now the importance, you know. You know, it's understanding now the importance, you know, of why, you know, us as Aboriginal people in this country, you know, need to be in dialogue with each other, you know, and why, you know, we need to start that connection back up, you know, with the land, you know, because the most powerful, you know, the most strongest thing that we can have, a relationship that we can have, is a relationship with land, you know, us as individual, us as humans and the land. And once one of those are broken, then a relationship between human and human is broken, you know, is dysfunctional, and a relationship between land and human is breaking up and dysfunctional. We can see that, you know, as a whole, you know, around the world, you know, and that's what, you know, this whole week's about. It's about, you know, you know, starting that national movement up, you know, again, what we once had, you know, back in the 80s, you know, when 35,000 Aboriginal people descended on Sydney, you know, in 82, 1,000 Aboriginal people descended here, and in 1972, with the establishment of the 10 Embassy, you know, and also the Aboriginal flag, you know, Aboriginal people identify strongly with the Aboriginal flag, you know, that's, you know, whether they're conservative Aboriginal people or, you know, politically conscious Aboriginal people, you know, they still identify strongly with the Aboriginal flag, regardless of their, you know, political views. And this is something that we need to start, you know, creating the opportunity, you know, for our people, you know, to galvanise around, you know, a movement, you know, just like Aboriginal people love the flag and will die for the flag. You know, that's what we need to do. You know, and that's the whole thing about having all these discussions and all these different mobs come from all around the country. You know, and after each rally and after each forum, we said, where to now? You know, the grandmothers group on Monday, they said, where to now? You know, and they've actually created momentum to go to Canberra, you know, the February the 13th, you know, next year, you know, to march on Parliament, you know, and to sing the fire up down at the Tent Embassy, you know, the Native Title Forum, other the Beyond Native Title Forum, you know, Land Rights and Sovereignty, they said that, you know, the 26th of January, you know, we want to send a delegation over to Western Australia, over to Perth, you know, and help them mob sing up the embassy over there and help them mob fight against that fascist, you know, state, you know, which is the capital for black murders, you know. They're killing Aboriginal people wholesale in that state and getting away with it, you know. Whether it's black fellas frying in the back of the car, you know, getting picked up for $1,000 fines, you know, getting hit by cars and, you know, nothing happening. You know, they're killing Aboriginal people in that, you know, in that state, you know, at a high rate, you know, and we need to, you know, go over there and help our people. You know, one thing about, you know, pre-colonisation, we had a responsibility to look after our mob, you know, and punish our mob, you know, to put them in line, you know. And in 2014, you know, and especially in 2015, we still hold that same responsibility of going up there, you know, of going anywhere, you know, with the rights or with the responsibility of looking after our mob, you know. And after the Young People's Forum, you know, we started a group called WAR, Warriors of the Aboriginal Resistance, you know, and what we want to do with that is we want to galvanise, you know, the next generation of freedom fighters, you know, of liberators, you know, that's what we want to do, you know, we want to show our old people that, you know, yes, you know, we are here, you know, and yes, we want to stand on the front foot, on the front line next to you, not behind you anymore, aunt, not behind you anymore, aunt, you know, we want to stand next to you. You know, we want to cop the same stuff that you used to cop back in the day, whether that's beatings or getting locked up. You know, the in terms of has things changed? Has things got more positive? No. Has it got more worse? Yes. That's the only thing that's ever really changed, you know, from my point of view as a young person, you know, and that's very, very important, and that's why we must, as Aboriginal people, take up this responsibility as an honour, you know, and as something that we must do, you know, for our old people, you know. And today, you know, we're seeing about, you know, 400 to 500 Aboriginal people, you know, descend on Brisbane and march through the streets of Brisbane, you know, for the black deaths in custody, you know, rally. I should say for the black murders in custody rally, you know. And we had Lex Watton, you know, get up and talk, you know. You know, Lex is, you know, everybody knows his story from Palm Island. You know, we had Shawnee Harris, who's from WA, whose niece was murdered, you know, in a Western Australian jail, you know, and he basically organised the National Day of Action. You know, we had, you know, Sam Watson, you know, Wayne Uncle Coco, you know, all these, you know, people have been doing a lot of stuff around the country, you know, have been on the front line for so long. You know, they were marching, you know, for many years, you know, and then we got back to the park, you know, and we went around the fire, and what we did was we, you know, us as young fellas, you know, we wanted to stand up there and, you know, after this rally, you know, let our old people know that we're here and that we want to stand on the front line, you know. And there's going to be that time when it's just us young fellas and our old people's not there. You know, this is the best time now to do it, you know, while we still have our old people here, you know, to build that political consciousness off, you know, get that political consciousness off them, and also that cultural knowledge. You know, the two things that we must carry with us, you know, in this world is, you know, having a clear political consciousness about what's going on, and also that cultural knowledge of who we are and where we come from and where we need to be. You know, if we carry those with us, you know, we can go anywhere.
It seems like you've got a lot of quite clear and, you know, well-planned strategies for movement building in the future, which I guess this is partly about. Is there anything that you want to add coming towards the end of this week of events that you've run, and I guess on the eve of what looks like could be a new era in, black activism in Australia?
Definitely, you know, and, you know, nations must fight for self-determination. And, you know, what this whole gathering is here, you know, over the last 8 days is about nation building, you know, is about galvanising and giving our people, you know, our rights, our responsibilities, our dignity, you know, our hope. You know, that's what I see from this weekend is hope, you know, hope for the future. You know, and it's nation building. And what we must do when we nation build is go back to where we come from, you know, and sing that fire up, you know, and sing them stories up, you know, on our country. You know, we need to galvanize the streets of wherever we live, whether it's in the big cities or in the small country towns. It might be hard, you know, for mobs in the small country town because they're, you know, they're the more racist and the more outright, you know, bigot, fascist, you know, places, you know, in this country. But still, you know, it's got to think of the old people that went before. You know, who fought in those back streets and those alleys and got beaten up and gotten killed. You know, we're on the journey of nation building. And, you know, we must, you know, like, whether we're talking about independence, you know, what Scotland were fighting for, what Scotland just missed out on, you know, whether we're talking about treaties, which is all over North America and New Zealand, or whether we're talking about a seventh state, which Michael Mansell is talking about, you know, in Tasmania, or whether we're talking about making building republics, you know, what Michael Anderson and Fred Hooper is doing. Before we can do that, we must build nations. Mm. We must nation build. Sorry, mm. You know, our nationhood, you know, as individual nations, you know, is a responsibility to ourselves, to our family, our clan, and our nation. You know, and once we, you know, tribal nationalism, once we build tribal nationalism, then on a pan-Aboriginal nationalism stage, you know, then can we, as a collective movement, you know, have a more right to fight, you know, for independence, you know, for a treaty, you know, for a republic, you know, for all these other things that all these other people are saying. No disrespect to, you know, my uncles and aunties that are speaking that, you know, but before we must do that, you know, we must nation build.
Mm. Last thing before we finish, for our listeners who are largely non-Indigenous people, I mean, I've seen a little bit of the vast amount of work and time and money that's gone into making this possible. I mean, getting people from around Australia here isn't cheap. What would you ask people to do to support this massive project of nation building?
I guess, you know, for Aboriginal people, you know, keep that conversation going, you know, because that this conversation belongs to you. Just because we're talking about up here in Brisbane, it doesn't mean it's got to stay here. You know, it's yours as much as it is mine. You know, it's our freedom that we're talking about. You know, so, you know, take it. You know, because the only justice that we'll ever get is the justice that we take. You know, for non-Indigenous peoples, you know, that want to support, you know, educate non-Indigenous peoples, you know, because it's hard, you know, educating somebody that doesn't necessarily have an understanding, you know, of what's going on, you know, with us, you know, Aboriginal people, you know, who don't necessarily understand what's really going on, you know, and at the same time trying to, you know, push this along, you know, it can be very, very difficult. But just always remember, like, the non-Indigenous peoples and the Aboriginal peoples, you know, we all have a part to play within this nation. You know, when this, you know, when we're ready as people, as Aboriginal people and as non-Aboriginal people, we must remember that all of us can only answer the question and to only answer the question of how we want to see this nation in the future. You know, that question belongs to all of us. You know, like what I was saying before about nation building, that also needs to happen in non-Indigenous communities, non-Aboriginal communities, you know, nation building. You know, when you're building that, always must respect you know, what went before you and what you can do, you know, to build a better nation for all people.
We will not negotiate with minor state of tribal government or anyone on our culture, on our land. You know, if people say, oh, you're going to finish up with nothing, well, then so be it. But at least our hearts will tell us that we did not sell out our country and our culture and heritage for a few scungy dollars.
Subscribe to 3CR so that your dollars support Indigenous voices and the struggle for land justice.
For Aboriginal people, the greatest grief of all is seeing the country destroyed. And somewhere along the line, we have to realise that we don't actually have the right to do that, that nothing we've ever done has given us the right to do that. Now, you know where I stand on this, because I'm so simple-minded, I think we've just got to admit that this is an Aboriginal country. Just do it.
You're listening to 3CR. We're here in Musgrave Park as part of our live coverage of the Decolonisation Before Profit events up in Brisbane. We've just had the Deaths in Custody rally, and I'm sitting here with one of the strongest fighters who's been working really hard against Deaths in Custody for quite a long time, actually. Sean, do you want to introduce yourself and tell us where you're from?
Yeah, hello. My name's Sean Harris. I'm Jalika Jew's uncle. I'm Nanda Wadjeri Yamaji from Midwest Western Australia, and on the National Day of Action for Jalika Jew, Deaths in Custody protest organiser, that which went down nationwide a couple of weeks or so ago. Yeah.
We just had the rally, and it was one of the biggest ones, it's the biggest one we've had so far this week. Luckily, there wasn't any violence from the police. It seemed to go pretty well. Were you happy with everything today?
Yeah, well, I was quite happy with everything today, actually. You know, I've flown over from Perth as an invited guest to speak at this Deaths in Custody rally, and yeah, I'm very happy with how things went down, actually, apart from being a bit of a scorcher of a day. But yeah, I'm happy with how it went down and how we've got the international stage to make our point through, which we did have a lot of media there today as well, you know, a bit more than previous rallies, I dare say, yeah. So
one of the reasons that you're so involved in this is because of a tragedy that happened to your family in the past few months. Do you want to tell us about what happened to your niece, Jalika Jew?
Yeah, well, back on 4th of August, we got news from the terrible news from the passing of my niece in the South Eden Watch House in Western Australia. She was apparently locked up in the watch house for 3 days over unpaid fines, which that is still not known at the moment. We still don't know exact details about anything like that. We've had little cooperation or contact with the police or the government and the health system, for that matter, in regards to my niece, Miss Jew. And, the families are broken and shattered. We're very shattered. That's why I flew over, to help keep my niece's voice out there and her face into the media, and to help keep addressing deaths in custody through the nation, and to try and get justice for my niece, but also justice and answers for previous deaths in custody that have happened in the past and still in the present. And all these families still have not had answers either, you know, from, be it death in custody a year ago or 5 years or, you know, 10 or 20 years ago. There are families coming out that have found that extra courage to come out and speak out about it after all these years, since this nationwide protest for Jalika, which is, we've all had enough, and we're all getting that courage to stand as one now, because it's not just nationwide support, we've got global support from the start, and to be here in Musgrave is pretty awesome, and to be in, have a G20 stage to protest on, to get out to the world. We've got, apparently there's 3,000 odd media from all over the world of all sorts, so yeah, now is the time to get all sorts of Aboriginal or Indigenous issues out into the spotlight while we have 20 of the so-called top world leaders in, well, pretty much a stone's throw from us.
You've been talking to a lot of media, and you've also been making T-shirts and organising a National Day of Action. Do you want to tell us a bit about how you've managed to organise such a huge amount of a response to this, how have you been doing the work that you've been doing?
Well, my hands were pretty tight after my niece had passed away, for obvious reasons, from grief, and we had to wait until the funeral service and whatnot until we could start going to the media and stuff. So as soon as I had permission to help and do what I do, which is I put the call out to all of my friends all over Australia, of friends of all sorts and colours and whatnot, to see if they could help support the Geraldton and South Headland protest rallies for Jalika Ju. It didn't take too long. It only took a matter of a few days or so, and like we soon had rallies up and running in pretty much every capital city in Australia, bar Darwin and Hobart, on top of South Headland and Port Headland. South Headland and Geraldton, sorry. They all put their hands up to help from the very beginning, but they, due to respect, they could not do much as well, just as I couldn't. But I'm pretty happy that they all, when I did have the chance to put the call out for help, everyone did put their hand up like they said they would, and hence, it didn't take too long to rally up a national day of protest, which simultaneous as well. Plus, there was many parliament politicians sitting in parliament on that day, which worked out to be a bit of a bonus for us as well. You know, that's just people of all colours have helped and worked tirelessly through all this. You know, I can't thank everyone enough, organisers plus helpers and supporters plus the people, you know, the thousands of people that turned up on the day to support the rallies in every location.
You were telling me the other night that you've been going to protests against deaths in custody for years, since, I think you said, since John Pat died and was murdered. One of the biggest criticisms that people have had is that the police, you know, investigate themselves in these circumstances, and you know, there's no accountability to the people, no accountability to the families of people harmed. Do you think that that's changed at all in the years that you've been active?
When Mr. Pat had passed away, I was only actually 6 years older, I think. Although my first protest, death in custody protest, was when I was 11 years old in Geraldton, back home in Western Australia, and for a close family friend in Edward Cameron. He was a death in custody found hanging in the Geraldton watch house. I was 11 years old then. I remember marching down that street, and here I am, you know, 26 years later, having to lead a national rally against death in custody for my niece. You know, it's a generational thing. My daughter, my family, we marched in three separate locations in WA. We're just broken and shattered, and we are not going to sit down. We're going to keep standing up and fighting the fight we're not going to be silenced, and we're in this for the long haul. And this is just the beginning.
Yeah, that's what I want to ask you about next, is you've been here for most of the week meeting different Aboriginal activists from around Australia, and there's even from around the world, actually, and participating in the events here. And how do you feel that that's been in terms of getting to where you want to be in the future, and feeling like you've got some plans and a plan of attack for the future, really?
Yeah, well, we've been a few steps ahead of the police and the system, etc., since the start of all this. So they've messed up with my niece's case and her death in custody on so many levels, on so many times, you know. It's not just the one thing that they've done wrong. They've done a lot wrong. They need to be held accountable. We want answers. We have had pretty much zero answers from the whole system, the police, the health system, and the government. Now, they're going to keep murdering us, and because that's what it is. They're murdering us, and they're getting away with it. 339 recommendations since the Royal Commission. The national average is thereabouts just a smidge over 20% that have been implemented. Now, that's 60 to 70 nationwide average out of 339 recommendations. Being Western Australia, and one of the most redneck states in Australia, the average of recommendations that have been implemented in Western Australia is around 10% from the figures that I've been seeing and getting fed to me. That speaks volumes, because WA is one of the most racist states, or I'd say the most racist state in Australia. And for the national average to be 20% of recommendations implemented is pretty disgraceful in itself, and yet for Western Australia to have half of that, 10%, 10% of 339 recommendations is pretty much 30 to 40, and that's, I personally think that's, that's less, but that's Western Australia for you. They just want to keep killing us and getting away with it. And simple little things like a recommendation to remove hanging points. Apparently they call them ligature points, just to keep their conscience a bit better. They're hanging points, so it's a pure fact. They still haven't removed all hanging points from all these jails all over Australia. You're pretty much maybe one or so here and there, but it doesn't bloody take too much to grind off a hanging point and cover it over. You know, they are leaving things like little recommendations, things like that, that will stop deaths in custody. They purposely leave out, because they know that the blackfella will find that hanging point if they're suicidal or whatnot. And even if they're not, the hanging points are there for the police to bash us and murder us and hang us up and say that we hung ourselves. Mm. You know, they cannot keep getting away with murdering us. And, yeah, well, we've all had enough. The whole world has had enough. The whole world has been watching, and they've been supporting us, First Nations, sovereign Australian people,
yeah,
for years and years. And now that we've gone global with Jalika, not just Jalika, but Death in Custody, before the G20 protests here, that just proves we had 50,000 online signatures for Jalika in a matter of 3 weeks, which is quite phenomenal in any language. That just goes to prove in itself that we have not just nationwide support, but global support. 50,000 in 3 weeks is just sort of unheard of when it comes to online petitions and whatnot. That proves that the world has had enough, and they're ready to stand by us too. I dare say that they're hoping, they're sort of thinking it's about time that we started standing up, you know, so they can stand up with us.
Yeah, and it's not, I mean, things like removing hanging points, I mean, it's insulting that they won't even make a change like that. Yeah. But really, Aboriginal people shouldn't be incarcerated in their own land.
Yes, well, that's right. There isn't just no jurisdiction. The sovereignty never ceded. There's no treaties. They're getting rich off our resources on stolen land, hence stolen North Australia. The Stolen Wealth of Australia is not a country, it is a registered business on the stock exchange. So it's pretty much a free-for-all land grab and a resource grab to get rich and wealthy for multinational corporations, mining, etc. as well. They don't care what happens to our land. They can poison our land, mine it, poison all the waters through fracking, etc., etc., and then they can just all piss off back to their own homelands. They don't care. Oh, we'll just dig holes, mine our land, frack it, poison our waters. We'll cover back the holes up and say it's all right, you know. And then we'll go back home and we'll leave it. Don't worry about the blackfellas or their land. It's not our land. We'll just mess it up, get rich off it. Yeah, and we'll let the police kill the blackfellas as well. Less of a problem for us. We'll get rich more with less blackfellas to fight the fight against them. It's genocide, ethnic cleansing, there's no doubt about it. It's just pure racism.
Is there anything you want to add, especially anything that you'd like to see in for Jalika's case in particular? I mean, would you like to see it go to court, or, you know, what ideally would you hope for the future?
Well, we do not... Apparently the systems are saying it could take up to 2 years for a coronial inquiry, which is a load of crap as far as I'm concerned. It's just a farce. They do not want to do anything about anything when it comes to us First Nations people. They just kick us in the guts while we're down, still. And once we stand up and fight as united peoples, that scares the system. It scares them a hell of a lot, because the National Day of Action for my niece weeks ago, was simple testament as to what can be done when we all stand together, and not just blacks stand together with blacks. It's the whole country, all races and creeds who stand together. When we stand together, we can be a powerful force. And the system knows that, and we have the system on the run, which is the truth is on our side. The truth defends itself, and we're not afraid to stand up and keep fighting this fight. Sadly, it's just the beginning of a very long, hard road, but we have the strength, and we get the extra strength to fight the fight from everyone else around the country and the global support that we have, which... will keep us going all the way through this fight.
Yeah. Well, best of luck for the future. You've been listening to Sean Harris, who's Jalika Jew's uncle and the person who's largely responsible for organising the National Day of Action. He also spoke at the Deaths in Custody rally in Brisbane just recently. You're listening to 3CR, and this is part of our ongoing live coverage of the decolonisation before profits events at the G20 summit in Brisbane.
Indigenous people in Australia and the Pacific have borne the brunt of nuclear testing, and this was not done unconsciously. We found documents in the British archives saying that, yes, there is certain hazards, but only to primitive peoples, those that don't wear clothes and don't wash, unlike us British. So the sort of racism inherent in this whole operation was known and understood from the beginning, that these were the casualties of a larger imperial policy, and that they were able to bear the brunt because they were very small populations and didn't have much political voice. And as we fast forward to today, we see that same thing.
3CR, keeping you informed about Australia's nuclear past and present.
At such a time, it's important to have a voice like 3CR, steady, constant, sane, and committed to a nuclear-free Australia.
And yes, you can... Oh. turn that down a little bit. You've been listening to Alex Scott's couple of interviews from Alex. First up with Bo Spearham, one of the organisers here at the Aboriginal Sovereign Tent Embassy here in Musgrave Park in Brisbane, and also with Sean Harris, who's been over from WA. He's been one of the leading lights in the deaths in custody rallies that have been happening around the country and happened here in Brisbane on Friday as well. So thanks to Alex for those interviews. I'm now joined in our portable studio by Glenn Lockich, a photojournalist who presented a slide night here in the park the other night about some of his travels with various, I suppose, Indigenous groups, First Nations groups around the world, also with Sea Shepherd. How long have you been a photojournalist, and then how long have you been travelling?
I suppose if I say when I started, when I was studying 1992, that's when I started getting going, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So what are some of the places you've been to and some of the groups you've been involved in, some of the communities?
Various situations, I suppose. The first thing that really got me going was the forest blockades in 1995, headed down towards Bega and Eden, and that was a big political issue back then. Sort of stretched out from there, did a lot of anti-nuclear stuff, Jabiluka in the late 90s, Maritime Union dispute, what else was there? All different protests from World Economic Forum in Melbourne, mm-hmm. Crown Casino there, World Trade Organization protests in Sydney. I concentrated also on the effect of mining on Indigenous communities and the environment for a good few years in the Philippines. Nuclear testing in Tahiti in 95, the riots that happened there, and then Sea Shepherd more recently, and yeah, so just sort of whatever's happening.
Because some of the photos were quite confronting, the ones in the Philippines, looking at the kind of tailing walls, which, you know, backed basically onto some of the streams that the local communities use basically as their water supply. Mm. I mean, you kind of hear about all this stuff, but actually seeing the photos and stuff kind of, you know, gives you more of an idea exactly how close and how kind of dramatic the effects are when those tailings dams break or flood, which I think, you know, a lot of your photos showed the effects of that kind of on the communities themselves.
Mm. Well, that's the importance, I think, for me anyway, of documenting this sort of thing, is bringing the stories back. And for a lot of situations, for these communities, there's not really anyone telling those stories. And I've had, you know, I remember one time in a community in the Philippines where there was a Canadian mining company operating and security buzzing all around us, watching what we're doing, etc. After we finished, the community said to us, you know, thank you for coming, and please share with the world what's happening to us, because no one's telling our story. And so I sort of feel a little bit of a responsibility as well to these communities to try and get it out there. And I know there is so much going on, and unfortunately the general media doesn't cover this sort of thing.
Yeah. Mm. You know, I mean, in the general media, you kind of get, you know, a vague overview of stories, if they cover them at all.
Mm.
But, you know, actually having people living in the community and actually documenting what's actually happening to on a day-by-day basis, it's kind of important. And as you say, it's for people who it's actually happening to, having at least knowing that somebody seems to care about it, you know, kind of hopefully makes a difference, at least in that small way, and, you know, hopefully leads to actually, you know, people, activities, or, you know, people reacting and actually, you know, causing change either in the corporations or their own governments, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, I've always been of the belief that people can operate on all sorts of different levels. You know, like I suppose see my role as going and documenting those stories and then coming back and showing people what's going on, and then other people involved in issues or similar issues might want to take it up as a particular cause, etc. So I think it's very multi-layered, and I think, you know, I've always been of the view that whatever you're good at, if you can help in whatever way, that's, you know, best way to deal with it. You know, if you're a great street sweeper and, you know, might as well go and volunteer for an NGO and sweep their offices. You're a great accountant, you know, do their books, etc. There's always a place for people to do something.
Yeah, no, it's true. Some of the other great photos are from your trips with the Sea Shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're, again, it's, you know, you read the stories, you know, the confrontations with the whaling ships, the, you know,
Was it Bob Barker that was the one that ran?
Yes. Bob Barker. The first campaign I went on in 2009-10, that was the Waltzing Matilda campaign. The Artie Gill, which was sort of Batmobile-looking boat, that was rammed in two.
So. Yeah, that's right. It got completely destroyed, basically. How did you get involved with Sea Shepherd as an organisation?
A little bit of a funny story in that a friend of mine who's a nurse in Sydney, and she's been involved in a lot of activist campaigns and in Greens politics and that sort of thing, said to me that Steve Irwin was coming into town, into Sydney, and she said, why don't we go and check it out? And she was doing nursing on the side. She said, I'll volunteer as a nurse, and why don't you volunteer as a photographer? So I said, sure, we'll check it out. And when it came to the ship coming in, and I called her up and I said, let's go. And she said, oh, no, I've changed my mind. So I thought I'll head down there and see what it's all about. I'd read a bit about Paul Watson before, and I quite liked the way that they did things. So went for a bit of a tour on the ship, spoke to one of the crew, and I just felt really inspired by their work, and so I decided to just call up the head office in the States, and they asked me to send some photos in of what I'd done in the past, and didn't hear from them, and I thought, what's going on? Maybe they just didn't like the pictures, or they've really got photographers, etc. And about 2.5 weeks before the campaign was meant to start, I called them up and said, look, I'd like to know yes or no, because if I am going on board, I've only got 2.5 weeks to get organised. And she said, oh, well, I thought someone had called you. So I said no, and she said, all right, well, I'll get on to them anyway. So I got this call from Mauritius, from the Peter Hammerstead, who's now the captain of Bob Barker, a really nice guy from Sweden. He did an interview with me, basically letting me know it's no holiday and you've got to be prepared to risk your life, etc. And funnily enough, also, he sort of asked me what I thought about authority, because there's you've got to obey authority when you're on the ship. I said, look, to be honest, I've got an issue with authority, but I'm happy to listen to the captain when we're out in the ocean and all that. And he laughed. And I think everybody on board's probably got an issue with authority anyway. So it's probably the right answer for him. But next thing I found, 2.5 weeks later, I was on a plane to Mauritius. Yep. Sold my car, bought a one-way ticket, and arrived in Mauritius, and then took off a few weeks later from there.
Because the photos of the the anti-whaling campaign to stop the Nishimaru, I think it was. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Down in the Antarctic oceans. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of fairly wild place to be doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it is. It's wild in many ways. Wild in terms of its beauty and nature, etc. But in terms of the altercations and tailing the ships, it can get fairly hairy. But I suppose, in doing this sort of thing, you just set your mind to it. It's a bit like, demonstrators coming and protesting at the G20, knowing that there's always the possibility of the police doing something, mm-hmm. etc. But if it's something that you really believe in and you want to pursue, you just set your mind to it and just do it, no matter what the outcome. If there was something really serious, like in the last campaign I went on, the Operation Zero Tolerance, when we got pushed within 15 to 20 seconds of capsizing by the Nishimaru. We basically were told a couple of days before, this is what's going to be happening. Anyone that wants to go onto one of the other ships, feel free. So, you don't get, they're not going to put you into a very dangerous situation without you necessarily having a say in whether you want to be on board or not. If they've got time to organize it, that is.
Yeah, of course, stuff just happens, I suppose. Because there's that thing of, as you were talking about before, international waters, I suppose. In a lot of those places, it's kind of lawless in that way as well, isn't it?
It is. And that's also what I have said since being back about, in that one situation where we were pushed within, not that long of capsizing. I thought when I came, I got told to come in onto the bridge because it was getting too dangerous outside. And I sort of looked around, seeing the escape door, and thinking, that's going to be my way out. But you've got 5 minutes to be rescued in the icy waters. So, I lost the question.
The lawlessness of.
And so, in what actually happened in that situation where our engines actually failed and we had to press the Mayday button, and then they pulled back knowing that it was going international. It made me really, realize the importance of media, because if this would have happened 100 years ago, the Japanese whalers would have come back and they would have told the victor's story. Quite likely, we would have been sunk,
yep.
and no one would have got to find out about it.
Yeah.
And that's the importance, as well, having media on board. We've got there's a Discovery Channel as well as a couple of photographers too. Mm-hmm. So, media is vital.
Yeah, definitely in those kind of situations, because, it's, as you say, in the old days, it's quite easy just to sink the boat and just say, oh, they must have foundered somewhere and,
Yeah, exactly.
No survivors.
They hit an iceberg and,
bad luck.
Yeah.
Because, it is a kind of, as you say, everyone gets a choice, but it's kind of a heroic endeavour of the people involved because, those ships in the photos are like they're looming right over the top of, the Sea Shepherd ships are fairly large ships in terms of, kind of boats, but the whaling ships kind of just really loom right over them when they're getting close.
It does. It's 15 times the size of the Bob Barker. The crew on board, the last campaign we had 14 nationalities. You get such a variety of people coming from the first campaign I went on, there was a NASA astrophysicist, carpenters, we had a real estate agent, other activists, chefs, you name it. Just people really strongly believing in animal rights and feeling like they've got to do something.
Do you have, is everyone involved in the kind of day-to-day workings of the ship as well? Or do you just, have your kind of specific jobs or...?
I suppose the higher echelons of the ship, yep. like the captain and the
of
first
course,
mate
yeah, they
and that
do
sort
that.
Of thing. But they've got, other duties that they've got to look after in terms of, the maintaining of the ship as well as making sure that, there's all the coordination between the ships, etc. But in general, most crew on board have got to do other things as well. I had to, if in the downtime, especially because we were docked, the last one were docked in Wellington for 1 month.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to help with tours and you've still got to do the cleaning of the toilets and sweeping and all of that.
I suppose it's home as well as a campaigning ship.
Yeah, yeah. And then for my particular role, once we got started, then I had to do the day-to-day stuff as well as news photography. And then you've got the hours and hours of editing as well too, which takes a lot of time.
Yeah, of course. Mm. So what's any campaigns that you're looking at kind of joining? You mentioned you're going actually back out with the Sea Shepherd again.
Oh, I'm hoping to go back out at the end of next year again. It's just part of some studies that I'm doing at the moment, just sort of combining it in conjunction with the G20 at the moment. That's probably the main one. Other than that...
Is that back down to the Antarctic again?
Yeah. What seems to be happening at the moment is that for the this particular year, they're not actually going to be doing any whaling.
Mm-hmm.
They're not actually sending the factory ship down there, the Nishimaru. But there was a bit of a loophole in the International Court of Justice decision where they were allowed to... they couldn't justify killing 1,035 whales... for research, they're saying that they need to kill, 200 is an acceptable number, and that's most likely what they're going to be going for.
Yeah, it'll be an amazing trip. Hopefully they're successful in getting Japan to finally decide that the whole seed of calling it scientific whaling. Because, some of the photos with, just blood splattered across the word research on the side of the ship kind of reminds you that, they might call it research, but it is, just basically the slaughter of whales.
Yes.
Whatever research you get out of doing that, it's hard to imagine, really.
Yeah, exactly. It is a cover for it, and there's all sorts of issues behind it. One of them, I think, that does escape the media a lot is the whole Antarctic issue and the environment down there. When the Antarctic Treaty is up for renewal.
Is that 2041?
Yeah, about 2041. And it seems a long way away, but you're getting a lot of countries that are jostling for
land rights.
For land rights, etc. And, it's a concern in terms of resources and what they might be wanting to do with it in the future. All the fresh water, etc., etc.
Yeah.
I mean, if anyone's actually down... I suppose speaking to Melbourne, they're docked at Williamstown, so anyone that wants to pop in.
Yep, they've been down there for a while, yeah. There's been a few people from the station involved, yeah.
Mm.
down with helping them out. So, yeah, we do encourage people to get down and show their support for the Sea Shepherd. They're doing an amazing job. I mean, it's a heroic job kind of thing. They are kind of modern-day heroes, really.
Yeah, and also a lot of the volunteers around the world that are, you know, raising funds. And I remember when I was on board the first campaign, we had a letter sent in, an email sent in from a little kid who had spent something like, I forget what it was, about 2 months or 3 months selling lemonade outside his house, and then sent all the money into Sea Shepherd. Yep. You know, and it's all the people doing all that groundwork that really helps the campaign as well too. Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming in and speaking to us, Glenn.
Thank you.
And hopefully we can see some photos from some more of your stuff.
Sure.
In the future.
Okay, thank you.
You're tuned to 3CR, broadcasting live from Musgrave Park in Brisbane from the Aboriginal Sovereign Embassy. I'm going to play a quick track and then we'll be back almost, I think, to finish the show by then. But this is Bart Willoughby.
My name's Lionel Fogarty. I'm an Aboriginal author. I'm a poet. And my tribe is Mullinjali Yagara Mob from Bourne and Shearbeg Aboriginal community. So I have a different kind of inlook into other different relationships in other tribes. We don't all come restricted under native title. We all live our own kind of natural lives. But living our natural life is very hard in terms of our culture. And to redevelop it, we have to conquer English in a certain way. Because our culture is development all the time. But to redevelop it in this modern day, we need to understand English and to use it as a tool, as a mechanism, as a machine. So I wrote this poem here just recently. With my little bit of understanding, it'll come true. We own the East Restings. Where, brah? The G20 gives us solutions. She was wearing her G-strings on her way to the G20 tea and rich party. Where justice lives for those who write justice, then runs into injustice. G20, your future makers executed your loves of planted people for fears of their classes. Jihad, Lord Almighty, asked the rich to kiss poor farmers forever, their bread, tea mornings in the sunset off our East Peace. Those going to the summit thinking answers are heard and seen to our pooling fools into future. This all humans don't need blood money. Sufferers are the ones who have everything they have, blood money. Pain reigns where profit gains on the ones who have none, nothing, guia. But sisters, parents, G20 bungled us hanging in front of ourselves. Better brothers blend, bend, and drag the G20 back to where they come from. G20 bubs, our mum's money. Hey, we're not anti-rich, just pissed off on paying fashion holidays. Hey, we're not for the poor to stay poor and think they have a door. Treatment are their medications. Jihad is G20 bribes. Go away from our past people's lands.
And it's about time for me to get out of here. That we've just been listening to Lionel Fogarty, one of the elders here who's been in the camp, reading one of his poems about the G20. Big thanks to Glenn Lockich as well for having a chat. Sean Harris and Bo Spearman and Alex Scotts for doing those interviews, and also Dave Sweeney up at the start of the show. It's about time for Hot Damn Tamale. You can tune in between 3 and 5 tomorrow for our final cross from Musgrave Park here in Brisbane as part of the Aboriginal Sovereign Tent Embassy and the Decolonisation Before Profit Summit here happening at Musgrave Park. But now, back to everyone in the studios at 3CR.
You've been listening to a podcast of 3CR's live coverage from the G20 in Brisbane. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. To listen to more podcasts or donate online, go to 3cr.org.au.